Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Dr. James Braxton Peterson is Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, an analyst at MSNBC Cable News, and the founder of Hip Hop Scholars, which examines and promotes hip hop to cities and colleges across the country. For my theme song, my leather black jeans on, my body means on, partin' I'm getting my scream on. Dr. Braxton also has some very strong opinions on the long-term impact of the re-election of President Barack Obama on the black political world. Jim, welcome. First, I'd like to discuss the front-page disclosure in the New York Times, of all places, of Mr. C of Hip Hop Station 97, who allegedly solicited sex from a transgender. A debate on homophobia continues. Tell us about that.
It does. Big story in hip hop, big New York radio story. You know, Hot 97 has become an institution in this city for, playing mainstream popular music. Historically, Hot 97 has been the kind of space that was really homophobic. And there were DJs and personalities at Hot 97 that conducted these kind of like witch hunt like radio scenarios, trying to out so-called in the closet gay rappers, and that went on for a long time there. And so it's kind of like ironic just desserts that Mr. C, this is not the first time that he has been implicated in this kind of prostitution with a transgendered person type of scam. And so upon the release of this video of him interacting with a transgendered person, he then resigned promptly. And then the next day, I'm sure lots of folk in New York heard this, the next day he was on air with Ebro, who is the program manager but also does the morning show there, and they had a riveting and compelling conversation. And you know, initially I felt like Ebro wasn't as sensitive as he could have been in the conversation, but over the course of the half an hour of them talking, he showed so much support. And as the face of Hot 97 showed, that they had come a long way since the gay rapper witch hunt days, because he embraced Mr. C and he pleaded with Mr. C to come back on air. Even that day, Mr. C came back on air after he had resigned, and it looks like he's considering staying around. But the pain
and
the
emotion. What does it mean? I'm not really sure I understand why it's so important. And a lot of people, you're into it, you know it.
Yes.
The people who listen, they don't.
Huge story, because hip hop historically has been misogynistic and very homophobic, much like certain areas of our own society, like the military or like churches. You know, Hot 97 and hip hop, broadly speaking, has had its own sets of issues around homophobia. And in fact, if you look at language like the use of the term gay in hip hop parlance, which is used as a negative sort of adjective, or if you look at terms like pause or no homo, which was a popular term a couple years back, all these terms come out of the homophobia within hip hop culture. And so the language marks the ideology and the sentiment of the culture, which unfortunately and historically has been quite homophobic. Some of that comes from
Why did that happen? Why was it so homophobic?
It's interesting, because it seems ironic for music that came up with punk rock and came up in out of disco in the New York scene, for it to be homophobic seems quite ironic. But in the sort of second and third stages of hip hop's development throughout the 80s and 90s, hypermasculinity became a central component to the music. And so, you know, just being a hypermasculine, over-sexualized, ultra-violent figure became one of the sort of linchpins, particularly within gangster rap, but also just broadly speaking within the music, of the kind of characters you would see in those narratives. And so that kind of characterization of masculinity within hip hop really erased all different other forms and all different other manifestations of masculinity within the music. So intellectualism, any kind of alternative sexuality, anything that didn't subscribe to this really pumped up, muscle flexing, violent, misogynistic, homophobic figure was in many ways not allowed within the cultural sphere.
Will the lyrics change now? And you're an expert on lyrics. Come on, we're talking about rap. We're talking about the origins of why people say what they say.
Right. So No, the lyrics are not going to wholesale change. You know, Macklemore and Ryan Lewis have this great song out off their debut album, the album that also has Thrift Store and a few other things on it. And in that song, you can hear...
I'm warning you, 90% of the people who listen to this have never heard these names before.
They've heard of Thrift Shop.
Say.
They've heard of the song Thrift Shop.
Maybe.
Macklemore, some of your listeners will have heard of Macklemore because he's a white rapper and has ascended to quite a bit of popularity recently. He's from Seattle. But they should listen to his, he has a song that's an anti-homophobic song that came out before this Mr. C thing. So you see some cracks in the armor of hypermasculinity within hip hop.
Why is it important?
It's important because hip-hop culture, if it wants to stay relevant, has to understand that it's got to speak to the millennial generation. And millennials have very zero tolerance for some of the social hang-ups that older folk like myself have.
But young people know this.
Yeah.
It's the over 25s that are having trouble with hip-hop and rap.
Well, it's young people know that.
And they're imitating it all over the place.
They are. But young people also know that we live in a world where marriage equality is kind of a given. They want to live in a world where race, sexual identity, and gender are not the over-determining factors in their identity, number one.
You mean same-sex marriage, right?
Same-sex marriage, yes. And are not the over-determining identities in terms of how they navigate their lives and their social existence. And so hip-hop culture's got to catch up to the younger generation around some of these social issues. And a lot of us in older generations have to understand things have changed. You know,
really? Have they changed?
Things have changed. Not as quickly as we would like. We're still not as progressive as a society as I would like to see. But when you look at the president supporting marriage equality, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you look at the states that have gotten on board with marriage equality, there's been significant movement on LGBT rights over the last couple of years.
And you think everybody knows what LGBT rights mean, huh?
I think more and more people know. That
you don't have to explain it as much
in
your classroom?
No, not on college campuses, because the LGBT community on college campuses has created a safer space there.
Well,
so
people know.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. And sometimes people will add queer to that or other.
Which is really strange, considering that queer was one of those, was something you never mentioned unless you really wanted to get punched in the mouth.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, what we see, like in the use of a term queer, the reappropriation of language as one of the ideological moves that we make to become more progressive around some of these issues. And so there is some movement. The Mr. C story is really hugely important. A black male DJ, also from Trinidadian background. So he's got the sort of trinity of homophobia in his life. He's got hip hop, the black community, and also being from the West Indian sort of culture and community where there's quite a bit of homophobia and violence against gays in those communities.
Is there a difference? You're head of the Africana Studies at Lehigh.
Yeah.
The difference between Africana Studies and Caribbean and...
You
took a deep breath.
We could talk about this for a long
time. No, just give me 30 seconds.
Africana Studies is the study of the experiences, culture, literature, history, politics, sociology, psychology, and linguistics of black folk throughout the black diaspora. So that's continental Africa, the Caribbean, America, Europe, all over the world, the dispersion of black people all over the world. And so Caribbean studies or African-American studies or African studies can all be disciplines within the rubric of Africana Studies. So Africana Studies, broadly conceived.
Do you know people who, because of this homophobic aura that seemed to permeate the hip-hop world, stayed in the closet because they were afraid to come out and afraid to talk about that?
I don't know people personally, especially not any artists personally. And again, there's been this terrible history of trying to out artists. But we know...
Hip-hop?
Yep, out hip-hop artists as being gay.
How do they do that?
Different radio personalities, different journalists will insinuate certain things, will say they have information that they never release, try to use different images of artists doing different things to sort of suggest things. And artists have been, you know, reluctant, if not resistant, to talk about their sexuality within that context. Artists like Queen Latifah and others who have been, I guess, accused of being gay have been smart and reluctant to talk about that.
People did not see you raise both fingers to indicate there were quotation marks around that. that. Yes. Yeah, it's not television. Yeah. You MSNBC people are terrible. This is radio. It's NPR radio.
Air quotes around accused because that may not be the best way of talking about it. But there have been these witch hunts. Artists have been, become nervous around some of those situations. And I think when you look at, and I'm less interested in artists and more interested in the everyday people who consume hip hop, understanding that hip hop culture has got to have a broad tent and be tolerant of all folk.
That's the voice of James Braxton Peterson, Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, and if you've been listening closely, an expert on hip-hop, which has transformed American culture. I want to know a little bit about you. See, born in Newark, New Jersey.
Yes, indeed. Brick City, baby.
Brick City, baby? That's not Newark.
That's Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey is affectionately nicknamed Brick
City.
Guy
goes from Newark to Duke to another pretty good college.
Right.
And now Lehigh.
Trained in the Ivy League, yeah.
My God.
You know, I say this often, I have kind of the best education that money couldn't buy because I was given quite a bit of opportunity, came up in inner city Newark and did a program called A Better Chance, which places inner city kids and first generation college kids into these great high school systems, public and private, particularly in New England, but throughout the country.
Growing up in Newark.
Growing up in Newark was...
not easy.
It's not easy, right? I came up in a neighborhood where, people got shot. You know, I remember coming outside my house once, somebody's brains blown out in the car in front of my home. Came up in a community where I was mugged and robbed. I had to worry about people trying to take your coats and shoes and things like that. It was a tough upbringing. But I also came up in a community that had the politics of Amiri Baraka. I came up in a community that was politically engaged, intellectually engaged, and had a rich history of rabble-rousing and organizing around important issues.
You say Baraka, and my age will say that he was a poet under another name, right?
Leroy Jones, that's right. That's right.
So when you grew up and you were sensitized to all this kind of stuff, did you ever think that someday I'd really want to be a spokesperson for an entire language, an entire way of looking at things?
You know, I did not, I could not.
How'd it happen?
I could not have conceived of my career very, very early on. I grew up thinking I was going to go into law. But one thing that I did
know. Cory Booker-like, huh?
Well, my parents, God bless them. My parents understood that education was the key to success for all their children. And they drilled that into us very, very early.
How many of them were you?
There are a total in my family of seven, five between my mom and dad. And all five of us have excelled. I have a brother who's in the education system in Newark as a vice principal. I have a brother who owns his own business. I have another brother who's a Microsoft certified programmer and does very, very well. Then I have a sister who is a dentist, an orthodontist, actually, another sister who's a child psychiatrist. And so we've all done well, but that came from my parents really emphasizing education. And even though they didn't stay together over the course of our young lives, that was instilled in us pretty early. And I think that's the key to our success.
And you have a contract with the city of Newark, huh?
I do not have a contract with the city of Newark.
Are you working with them?
I have worked with Newark. Yep, I have worked with the school system in Newark under, actually, Raz Baraka, who is Amiri Baraka's son, who's currently
running for
mayor. A couple of great candidates. Actually, Shafar Jeffries is also running for mayor. There's some great candidates running for mayor in Newark right now. But under Raz's work as a councilman, I came in and spoke to Weekway High School, which has been historically challenged high school there in Newark, and worked with some teachers there and other leaders there. So I've done a lot of educational consulting in and around Newark, Philly, Pittsburgh.
How'd you get to Duke?
Duke?
And you didn't like, you said, I love what you said, Duke, the most wonderful school in the world, but it's racist.
Yeah. Well, listen, Duke has a long history with issues around race. That doesn't mean that it's not a fantastic institution. Actually, this year, Duke is celebrating 50 years of black students on campus. And I've been a part of some of those celebrations and speaking to alumni community.
Yes,
and to the broader
community
about it.
There was a party last year, if I remember, where they put on blackface.
Sure.
Old minstrel time in Duke University.
Sure.
It's hard to deal with.
Well, that happens a lot. I've been teaching on college campuses. There's not a university that I've taught at where there hasn't been some frat boy putting on blackface around Halloween. And I think there's two things.
Why don't they know better?
Some of them do. It's very easy to hide behind the veneer of ignorance once you get caught in a situation like that. I think instead of us always having this knee-jerk reaction to those things, and I try to tell this to my students because this happened at Lehigh not just a couple years ago. Instead of having a knee-jerk reaction, we have to do two things. Number one, we need to be about educating folk about Black history and about the history of minstrelsy and its connection to this present moment. I think that's what's really important.
So minstrel going back to L. Jolson.
Right, but you don't have to go back that far to see images of minstrelsy. You can see images of minstrelsy in popular culture. You can
minstrelsy.
You can see it in hip hop music sometimes. I think you got to teach about this and be vigilant about teaching about it consistently. This way, you can be proactive instead of reactive. And then also, I got to be honest, like those are not the things that really get me upset about the university system. You know
what does?
Well, I look at the percentages of Black students and students of color at elite institutions. I look at diversity.
Well, why aren't there more of them?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why.
Give me one.
Recruitment efforts aren't robust enough. Our commitment to diversity is not strong enough. And our sense of the ways in which diversity provides innovation at every level of our society is not convicted to the realities that we know about in terms of innovation. So lots of work to do. And that's not just student level. That's staff. That's faculty. That's high level administration. We have a long way to go as university systems.
You're at Lehigh. You've been at Bucknell. I forgot to mention that.
That's right.
And you've seen all of it.
I have.
And if you really want to get right down to it, the people in the admissions office, most of them are white.
Yes.
And they have white sensibilities. And they come from white neighborhoods and white suburban neighborhoods.
Yes. You could say the same about faculty. You could say the same about staff. You could say the same about high-level administration. And so listen, I'm doing this work at Lehigh.
Except on the football field, of course.
And everybody knows that, right? And when you look at, and that's where you find the preponderance of Black men at these elite institutions are athletes. And so in that model, we've got to understand that our commitment to these communities has got to move beyond entertainment and sports. And I think some people understand that, but it's a long road, requires a lot of work. And you got to be prepared to, people think you lower standards when you diversify institutions, but really what you have to do is expand what the standards are. You actually have to raise standards ultimately in order to become a more diverse institution. And that's long, hard work.
The irony of Black athletes is the fact that you couldn't find a Black sports writer in the mid-80s. They had to form a group, I don't know if you know this, called the Blacklist. Did you know about that?
I did not know about that, but I'm not surprised by
it. You know
that.
Why? It was called the Blacklist because there weren't enough Black sports writers around, so it was kind of a little bit of an irony about it.
Right.
They almost, NABJ, National Association of Black Journalists.
I'm a member of NABJ.
They kind of have stepped back because now there's about 450 Black journalists who happen to be Black covering sports.
Right. And listen, we've made progress.
We've made progress, but what is progress?
Progress.
You're going to measure it? You're going to tell me?
We can measure. Yes, it can be measured.
How do you measure it?
Well, closing the income inequality or the income gap or the wealth gap would be one way of doing it.
In this city, almost half the people are in poverty.
That's right. 46%, 47%?
Yeah, 47%. Yeah. That's right. So
that's not progress. Well, we've got to close those gaps. And again, remember, that's in the face of extraordinary wealth, right? New York is not too many cities are like New York. There's tremendous wealth here. And so we need to figure out what kind of society we are.
Why don't, I guess, a question, I don't know if it can be answered. Why don't we know how to tell the story of the people who can't tell it for themselves?
We do know how to tell the story. We have to have a deeper understanding of what the problems are. And so when wealth flows to the top 1%, that's an easy thing to do. You cut taxes, you deregulate. And these things occurred during the Clinton era. This is not all Bush's fault, right? These things were occurring during the Clinton era. But it's very, very difficult for those resources to flow in the other direction.
President Clinton was called the first Black president, I recall. And he got really mad about Sister Soldier.
He did. That was,
way back.
There is something in politics now called the Sister Soldier moment. And that crystallized around not just President Clinton's response to Sister Soldier, which was, remember, he responded to some of her music. Her music talked about hate, and it was actually critiquing hate in a very, very, I think, creative way.
We have to have the power to tell the truth.
But he took that opportunity to essentially equate her with David Duke, right? And that was a big moment for Clinton's candidacy, because what it did was it showed moderates and those on the right that he was willing to critique the so-called radical left. But people need to...
The man from Arkansas, of all places.
Of all places. People should see Sister Soldier's response, her statement in response, where she just dissects that entire argument. And you have to look at her work as well. Like, she's been working in the communities of New York and around this nation with camps for kids.
You have interviewed her. What did she say about it?
It's amazing. Well, my interview with her was less about the Sister Soldier moment and more about both her writing and her work. She looks at Richard Wright as one of her sort of literary forebearers and her autobiographical.
And how many people in high schools and colleges across the country know who Richard Wright is?
Not enough.
You're not getting off the hook.
No, not enough. Not enough. But Richard Wright, famous American black author.
A famous author who happened to be black.
Who happened to be black. He wrote Native Son, which was published in 1941 and was on the bestseller list, if you can imagine that, right? This is a really popular book. However, the main character, Bigger Thomas, is kind of this flat, reduced, stereotypical figure of black masculinity and black identity who goes through these sort of harrowing sort of experiences. Sister Soldier sort of riffs on that, riffs on his on Richard Wright's autobiography in her own autobiography, which is called No Disrespect, and then comes back to that sort of urban naturalism in her most famous novel, which is called The Coldest Winter Ever, an amazing novel, but it takes the sort of naturalism that you see in the works of people like Richard Wright to the extreme in sort of modern-day urban settings.
Sort of ironic, all this conversation we have, and really it's restricted to a very few number of people. You know, people don't care. There doesn't seem to be a feeling that people care anything more today than about money and the ability to feed themselves, because there is such a dichotomy between the rich and poor.
That's the neoliberal condition. You know,
the neoliberal condition.
Neoliberalism is an ideology that's been studied for quite some time now. But essentially, and I don't want to get into the weeds on this. People can look at some of my writing and other lectures if you want to hear more about this. But when you think about when political leaders on the left were prepared to basically make certain trade-offs politically, like they were prepared to trade off things like regulation in the economy, things like welfare reform and other sort of social safety net reforms for political points on the right and for a more moderate positionality, then you get that with the confluence of the developments of capitalism and a sort of ultra-materialism. And that's where you get sort of neoliberalism, just super free markets, nothing regulated, individuals feeling as if materiality over everything.
One more time to tell everybody who you are. Dr. James Braxton Peterson, who's Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, an analyst at MSNBC Cable News, and an expert, and as you've been listening, you know that's true, in hip-hop culture. You know, in the Democratic Party's primary for mayor recently in New York City, mm-hmm. the most talked about story, and you know where I'm going, right?
Sure.
Was a television commercial featuring the son
of de Blasio.
Yeah, go ahead. You do it.
Nice big afro.
He wasn't even stopped or frisked. Or questioned.
Well, at least not yet.
Not yet.
We have no information to be stopped and frisked yet. Most likely his father will become mayor and repeal the threshold for suspicion within the stop and frisk sort of tactic.
So what is that all about? Here was a kid in Afro who was captured, if you pardon the pun,
right.
on television.
Right.
And a lot of pundits are claiming, although I don't believe it, that this kid's Afro had a lot to do with how many votes... somebody got 40% of the vote against 26 against the second place finisher, Bill Thompson,
right.
who was black.
Right.
What is this all about?
Well, I think that New Yorkers are more and more, especially after the Bloomberg sort of Giuliani years, interested and invested in progressive politics again. That stat that we talked about early on, the 47% in New York City, New Yorkers by and large don't want to live in a city that has that level of stratification. They understand that some of the challenges we have with the police institutions, with the concentrated crime in certain areas, are sort of a byproduct of the ways in which Wall Street and the political class have sort of claimed New York for its own. Progressives in New York and most New Yorkers want New York to be a city for the people. And And someone like de Blasio, I think, represents some of that for folk. And
a maybe black Thompson, wife, by the way.
A black wife.
Who originally came out as a lesbian in Essence magazine, of all places. So there's no place that, in that fact,
he
his
can
name,
live and breathe in a lot of different subject positions.
His original name was Warner Wilhelm.
That's right.
He changed it to Bill de Blasio That's after right. his mom. He's everywhere.
He can occupy, if you will, a lot of different subject positions. People are critiqued him for politicizing his family, but if you study politics, politicians will often try to leverage their families and their family. They have to. We have to know who they are. We have to know who they are when they're not politicians, and part of that is understanding someone's family and family life. So de Blasio is a candidate, I think, that New Yorkers have, you know, he appeals to New Yorkers because of all those things, because of the variable subjectivity, because of his progressive politics. He's not scared to say he's liberal.
One more thing I want to ask you about, I want to get to, is what we talked about before, the marginalization of black politics, yeah. which has been created, ironically, from the election, now the re-election,
sure.
of President Barack Obama.
This is complicated, and I don't want to get into too much trouble.
You have about
on your
3 minutes.
Airways.
Oh, no, so, you can wait a minute. You got as much trouble as you want to. It's your airways now.
So I think that one of the byproducts of President Obama's tenure here has been a sort of identity crisis within the black community in some ways, where you have a lot of folk who want to support Obama based on the symbolic nature of his ascension as the first black president. And then you have a lot of folk who want to hold him accountable, not just to the black community, but to the politics of progressives and of progressive movements, which is the wave that he rode, particularly in 2008, to the presidency. And so you've seen that clash, and you have some black folk on the left who feel like they've been silenced because there's a lot of black people who support Obama. Sometimes they're referred to as Obama bots who will come after you if you attack the president.
Excuse me. Repeat that.
There are a lot of folk who support the president who are sometimes referred to as Obama bots.
Obama bots?
Obama bots, like Obama robots. They just support anything Obama.
Oh, bots.
Obama.
Okay, yeah, like yeah, robots.
Bots,
yeah,
yes.
Okay. No matter what he does.
And they
good
will,
or bad.
They will attack and they'll silence the criticism. And then there are, you know, there's what I think what this moment has shown is the complexity of black politics. You know, we can no longer assume that black politics is monolithic. Because if you look closely enough, and you don't even have to be paying that much attention, you can see people who maybe before 2008 were great friends, but post 2008 are on opposite sides of the progressive spectrum, opposite sides of the Democratic Party, opposite sides of liberal ideology, where there are some folk who feel like, again,
I have to ask you a question, just a quick
sure.
one. What is a liberal?
That's a great question. I've been arguing back and forth because I said publicly on MSNBC recently that Obama's not liberal. He's not a liberal. And
especially when it comes to the First Amendment.
Well, when it comes to the First Amendment, I would argue when it comes to the social safety net. I would argue when it comes to...
But give me the definition before we're out of time.
So the definition of a liberal is someone whose politics are left-leaning and who engages in progressive policy making to match those
which
positions.
Means?
Which means you are interested in equality and in humanity of everyone in this nation. You're interested in regulating markets, at least to the extent that everyone gets a fair shake, everyone gets a fair try in the American economy. And not that you're isolationist, but you are slow to enter into military conflict in the 21st century because you understand the geopolitical stakes for every military intervention that America
makes. See, I was glad to believe that liberals mean you were listening to somebody else talk. Without interrupting them.
No, liberal, listen, right? Well, Fox News will make you think that way. But liberals.
Hey, wait, MSNBC is also think the other way.
Sure. But liberals have got, it can't just be about ideology. Liberals has also got to be about policy. And that's where the substance symbolism divide, I think, has sort of fractured the black community around politics and President Obama.
Will it change? When he is not going to be president
forever.
No, in 2016 there'll be a new election. People are all lining up, black and white, which is interesting.
In all honesty, I it will change, but in all honesty, I appreciate the divisions, and I appreciate. I know it's been nasty for some folk. I know some people feel like there's been too much ad hominem attacks, and there's been too much of sort of enslavement to Obama. I understand that, but I like the political fragmentation to the extent that we can have some pretty serious conversations about what's best for progressives, for black progressives, and for the community.
Well, Dr. James Braxton Peterson, that was nice interview, who's director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. He's also an analyst at MSNBC News, cable news, and the founder of Hip Hop Culture, and in Denver with strong political overtones.
Yes. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for sharing your personal and professional life with us. The professionals on our program include Joanna Walper, who's a senior producer. Doug Doyle is executive producer, and Conrad Sanguinetti is our engineer. Conversations with Alan Walper is available online at WBGO.org and by subscription on iTunes. Until our next conversation next Tuesday, I'm Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Walper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.